Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LaCane. As part of our search for solutions, today we'll talk about what's working in environmental education and fisheries conservation. Experts say that 90% of the world's fisheries are either overfished or completely exploited, threatening both marine ecosystems and the health and well-being of nearly 1 billion people who rely on them for food and income. We'll talk about solutions to this problem in two segments. First up, Murray Fisher will discuss an exciting program in environmental education at the New York Harbor School. Our second segment will focus on what's working in protecting and restoring fisheries with two guests, Brett Jenks, head of the group called RARE, and Melissa Wright of Bloomberg Philanthropies. Our first guest, Murray Fisher, is executive director of the New York Harbor School, here to talk with us about environmental education at the New York Harbor School. Murray Fisher, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you, Eleanor. So glad to be on the show.
Yeah, I was very impressed. I saw your presentation at the Earth Optimism Summit sponsored by the Smithsonian, which was just chock full of solutions, and you really stood out with your story about what you're doing at the New York Harbor School. So could you just describe briefly for our listeners, what is the New York Harbor School?
Sure. The Harbor School is a public marine science and technology-focused high school on Governor's Island. We opened in 2003, and now I actually am not the principal of the school. I run the nonprofit New York Harbor Foundation that supports and helps fund the Harbor School.
That's great. And why do you think it's important to educate young people about water? You focus mostly on water there, right?
Absolutely. We are Harbor School is what's called a career and technical education school, which means that all of the 450 students, when they graduate, they can graduate with a technical credential in one of six marine fields, aquaculture, marine biology, marine systems technology, ocean engineering, professional diving, and vessel operations. And those six fields are all directly related not only to relevant workforce development skills for working in New York Harbor, but also they're aligned around a citywide project that we created called the Billion Oyster Project, where all the students can work on that project together.
So you've got a school. This is a real high school, right?
The real high school, it's every student that has to take all the regular high school curriculum, including the Regents, which are the New York State exit exams. And so about 20% of their school day is specifically focused around that, one of those six career and technical education programs. But the rest of their day has a lot of the traditional academic and physical education subjects that you would see in any other high school, except that Much of the time, the Harbor theme is integrated throughout those academic classes as well.
So you mentioned that the students there could get, in addition to the kind of the basic high school education, they can get a technical credential. You mentioned the six of them. And did I hear right that one of them is diving?
Correct. One of them is professional diving. And Harbor School is a member of the American Association of Underwater Scientists, which means we're the only public high school in the nation that allows students to become scientific divers, can certify students as scientific divers. And so
all of these programs are
3 years of sequential courses that terminate in that technical credential. And scuba diving is important not just for potential jobs in the recreational or commercial sector, but also because we do so much work underwater in New York Harbor, building and monitoring oyster reefs, that we have the students doing really relevant work in the harbor on those reefs also.
It sounds like it's a very kind of hands-on way to learn, and I wish that I had had a harbor school I could have gone to when I was in high school. I would have loved that.
Well, I think that's definitely one of the feelings that I had in creating it, was I'd wanted Look, I was, as a kid, someone who was in love with the natural world. And from a very early age, I was sure that I was witnessing the destruction of the things that I loved. And I knew that that's what I wanted my career to be about, helping to study and preserve and restore natural systems and ecosystems. And it was really frustrating to me that that was never relevant in my school. It wasn't relevant even through college. And it wasn't really that I felt fully engaged as a learner until I went to work at Riverkeeper after college. And so there I was at Riverkeeper. I was 23 years old. And I was given tons of responsibility for going out on the river, studying the fish, helping understand where the pollution was coming from, working with communities to help resolve pollution problems. And I remember thinking, this is what I wish school had been like. Mm-hmm. I wish I had been out in boats, out in the river, catching fish, talking to communities, helping solve problems that I had seen and that I was sure were happening since I was a little kid. I shouldn't have had to wait 20 years to be able to be put to work helping. Mm-hmm. But I think sort of one of the basic concepts behind Harbor School is that young people have a whole lot more to offer than we are letting them do now in society, and particularly when looking at the two gigantic threats of climate change and the loss of biodiversity. Why are we waiting until they graduate from college to put them to work? And what we found is that when you give young people, you know, that responsibility, they're much more likely to become responsible adults. And so it's been really exciting to watch it evolve really out of something that was just how I wish school had been.
That's fantastic. What a great story. And I think in some ways what you're doing is bringing education back to what it used to be, where it was more the young person would apprentice to the master and learn how to do blacksmithing or learn how to train horses or, you know, whatever the skill was, that you kind of did on-the-job training and learned a skill that was a productive that gave you a career. And you know, we've kind of gotten away from that, and people can spend, like you did, up until when you're age 23 and out of college before you're really actively doing things that you care about. So that's fantastic that you had that experience and that from that you created the New York Harbor School. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, it took a couple years. I was young enough to where it wasn't like I thought, this is how school should be, and now I'm going to go create one. I worked for a couple more years for the Waterkeeper Alliance internationally, and what I saw was not only frustration about the lack of connections of kids in New York City to their natural world, but I also saw with the environmental group where I was working, a very progressive environmental organization that was totally underrepresented, if you think about people of color and young people and women. It was largely an older white male movement. And I realized that here in New York City, there were, you know, there's a school about just about everything. There's art schools and finance schools and business high schools. High schools geared to getting young people excited about and trained in and aware of all these career pathways. But we weren't training young people in New York City to help manage and protect and restore our marine resources. And, you know, so it was sort of after a couple years at Waterkeeper Alliance, I started asking people questions. Why not a school about New York Harbor? And it was just an interesting case of just about every single person I asked that question to said, great idea, how can I help you? And so we ended up responding to a request for proposals that Mayor Bloomberg issued in 2002 to start new small schools and to phase out the largest, worst-performing high schools in the city.
Fantastic. Well, I really admire and appreciate your initiative, because even if the people do have the insight, they often don't have the follow-through to make it happen. But your school now, you've created it, it's accredited, and it's really grown. What year did you start the school?
We started in 2003 in Bushwick, Brooklyn. The founding partners of the school were South Street Seaport Museum, which brought sort of the maritime culture and history, The Urban Assembly, which brought more of the educational background and the political and development savvy for creating a school. And also Waterkeeper Alliance was the third founding partner, which is where the organization where I was working at the time when I created it. So we opened in September of 2003 in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We moved to Governor's Island in 2010. The city built us a beautiful new building on Governor's Island. We're the first permanent tenant on Governor's Island since the Coast Guard abandoned the island in 1995. And we then actually developed a second facility with a lot of private money, a new marine science and technology center. And interestingly, I just returned just now from Staten Island, where they will be creating a harbor middle school to feed harbor school students from the North Shore of Staten Island, and where there's already been a Harbor View Elementary School modeled after and inspired by us. And so in a couple years, there'll actually be a pre-K through 12th grade Harbor curriculum in New York City. And the same thing is happening in Brooklyn as well. So it's starting to spread a little bit beyond just the one Harbor school on Governor's Island.
That's really impressive. So talk a little bit about the substance on these, the technical training you're doing for the students. Give some examples if my daughter went to the Harbor School, what kinds of things would she be doing?
Sure. So first of all, every ninth grader, every freshman takes a class called Introduction to New York Harbor, where they travel to 18 different sites on the harbor. They study the built and the natural environment at that site. They monitor the water quality there. They monitor the wildlife, and they interview local people working there. And through that, they get to know sort of the geography and the culture and the natural history of the harbor. At the same time, they're introduced throughout that same year to all six of those career and technical education programs. And at the end of their freshman year, they make a choice of which program they want to focus on. And they're in that program for 3 years. And so each one of them has the technical credential that has been approved by industry and universities to say that this indeed, if you have this credential, you're demonstrating that you have the entry-level job skills in this field. And for example, aquaculture, we adopted a aquaculturalist certification from the University of Texas. As a sophomore in aquaculture, you will be learning how to maintain and monitor basic saltwater aquariums and fish tanks. So each student has pairs of students take care of their own fish and their own fish tanks. As juniors, the students are growing algae, which is the main food source for oysters. And as seniors, the students are actually growing the oysters for the Billion Oyster Project. That's just aquaculture all the way through to vessel operations, where students graduate when they're 18, they can sit for their Coast Guard launch operator's license, which is called OUPV, Operator of Uninspected Passenger Vessel License, where they have, if they have 180 days at sea, which class time counts towards that, they can actually sit and get their captain's license and be able to drive a boat with up to six passengers. And everything in between, those are just two of the six programs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so when the high school students graduate, is it expected that they're going to continue with their education, or they're going to kind of go out and become professional divers or marine scientists?
You know, we get a little bit of everything, Eleanor, and it's been really hard to generalize sort of which direction the students go. Mm-hmm. What we emphasize to our students is that we want college to be a real option for every student, so the goal is that every student get accepted at a college. And also, if college isn't right or if it isn't the right time, that we want a real job to be an option, which is why we offer those technical credentials. We've only had the career and tech ed certifications approved by the state for 2 years. It took about 8 years to develop those six programs. So they've only been state approved programs for 2 years, and so we're just starting to get data back about how many students graduate with those actual technical credentials which is normally about half per program, every student doesn't take and pass that final exam. So it's about half per program. And then a lot of those students who do take and pass and get that credential, a lot of them end up going to college anyway. And so it's not like we are yet at a point where we are the pipeline in each of these six programs directly into those industries. Some of them, like our vessel operations program, does place a lot of kids right after high school working on boats in New York Harbor. Some programs, like our marine biology research program, almost all those students go into college and study science in college. Each program is a little bit different, and what I found is it's very hard to generalize, even if you look at the data, and frankly, we've only had these programs state approved for 2 years. Our data is pretty sparse and a little bit young still.
Yeah, but the wonderful thing about your New York Harbor School is that you get the young people excited about learning, and they're learning by doing something that actually is working to help restore the oceans and the waterways there. And I would imagine a lot of them get bit by the bug and want to go on to marine sciences or other things. And it's so great that you're giving the young people an avenue to do that. I know so many students who graduate from college and they're weighed down. The average student has a student debt of about $35,000, some of them much more, and they still don't have a clue what they want to do, and they end up, you know, getting a job in a Starbucks as a barista or something. And you're just really doing it such a great way of engaging and inspiring the next generation to care about the ocean and marine life.
Well, I think it's, I mean, that's an interesting point that you make, because, yes, I feel good about what we're doing in terms of engaging, inspiring the students to make a difference, to participate in, the, you know, a new restoration or science-based economy. But, you know, what's frustrating is that there's a lot more jobs, even for our graduates, working at Starbucks than there are working as a marine biologist. You know, and so even if we've trained those students and gotten them excited for those careers, it doesn't mean that there are jobs available for them there necessarily. And so this is something that is, you know, a much bigger problem. And certainly part of what we're trying to do is not only provide access to those kinds of jobs, but make access to those jobs more equitable. You know, the average New York City public school student, there are 1.1 million kids in New York City public schools. 80% of them are not white. And yet, if you look at the demographics of people who work on or around or in or on behalf of the marine environment countrywide, it's still really not that diverse of a career. And so, I think that part of it is about making the access to those jobs more equitable, and, you know, frankly, trying to get. You know, the other part of it, part of why we created the Billion Oyster Project, is we really wanted, you know, restoring the local ecosystem to be a really big and relevant part of this city's culture and of this city's policies and of how the city spends money even. And so almost the ideal vision would be that Billion Oyster Project is doing so much work restoring oysters that we're hiring, you know, harbor school students to do that work after college or after high school.
Very interesting. And all your students are, it's a public school, it's for residents of New York City only, is that right? Or do you let other students apply?
That's correct. It's a public school. You have to be a New York City resident. And it's not a... there's not an application. It's a pure lottery where students just put down that they're interested in Harbor School on their high school choice form. And then, you know, say it's about 1,000 students who do that. There's a pure lottery, and we get placed with about 125. And so some of those students could be your, you know, really high-achieving young person who wants to be a marine biologist, but plenty of those students Mm-hmm. Maybe their guidance counselor put down at, you know, Harbor School. Maybe their parent did. And so we get at Harbor School a really, really fascinatingly wide range of kinds of students, because there isn't that screen. Mm-hmm. There isn't an application. A student or their guidance counselor or their parent just has to put down Harbor School on their high school choice form.
Which, yeah,
I think
that's
is,
great.
By the way, which I think is really amazing, because it ensures that we are still doing the job of trying to sell that this work is important, or that this work is cool, or that this work is necessary. And we're not just given 125 freshmen who already know that and are fired up about it. That would be a different school.
Right.
That would be sort of almost an elite marine science and technology school. That's not us.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious. I just happened to be at the Rachel Carson's house in Silver Spring, Maryland recently, and it reminded me of the incredible work that she did as a marine scientist, writing about the oceans and then writing Silent Spring, which a lot of people credit as the beginning of the environmental movement. Do the students there read Silent Spring, or do they know about Rachel Carson at your school?
You know, well, first of all, there is a Rachel Carson School for Marine Science on Coney Island.
No way.
In Brooklyn, yep. So I want to do a shout-out to them.
Even oh, amazing.
We unfortunately don't have a really strong relationship with them, which is part of the crazy frustration about there being 1,800 public schools in New York City. It's just hard sometimes to keep track, and we're on Governor's Honor, sort of focused on doing our own thing. So there is a school named after her that I know is probably doing a much better job of reading her books. It's a good question. There's so much incredible literature and scientific work about the sea and the ocean that we do read, and that we have a marine policy class, and we have a maritime literature class, and certainly in all of our career technical education programs. Mm-hmm. They have books and literature they read about those subjects. I'm not sure, actually, though, if we have a class where they read Silent Spring.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, well, you're right. There's just been an explosion of literature on it.
No, it is an amazing book. And I think sometimes people forget that so much of her work was as a marine biologist and marine writer as well. So I think that we tend to forget that sometimes.
That's right. Well, I think her first book was The Sea Around Us. It was all about the oceans and the marines, and she was in love with the oceans, and that's why she did the work she did. So I have a practical question. You've got all these students on Governor Island off of Manhattan. What do the students do about getting to classes? Do they all kind of have to get on a ferry to get over to school?
There is. There's a ferry that runs every half hour in the early morning, turns, I think, at 9:30 is the last one on the half hour, and then every hour after that it leaves from Lower Manhattan right next to the Staten Island Ferry. It's a really big ferry, the same ferry that the Coast Guard used when they were out at Governor's Island. It's free, runs all year round. It's only, the island is closed to the public October through May. And so Harbor School, with a lot of contractors and some Park Service people in Governor's Island and administrative staff, go out there, but it's pretty quiet, and the Harbor School students sort of feel like it's their island in a way.
Right.
But then come May, the public is open to the public, and on a warm June day, there'll be 5,000 people come out to Governor's Island, even on a weekday, and on the weekends even more than that. And so that's a little bit complex, because we have two buildings that are about 10 minutes apart from each other, and students will walk in between classes at the same time that there's thousands of tourists on field trips and having picnics and having a good time. And so, but it's an incredible, look, if you think about the places where you spend time and the environments where you spend time is impacting the kind of person you are, you can't imagine a better place for a school like this and a public school than on Governor's Island, where you're surrounded by nature and by history and by amazing programs, and all the people who come out to visit are all in a good mood because they've come out on their free time. So it's a really incredible educational setting that we are so lucky that we moved out there in 2010. Even though it's tough not really, you know, leaving the community where we started in Bushwick, Brooklyn was tough because there's not only did we have really great relationships with that community, but also, you know, in Governor's Island, we don't really have a community. It's not, there isn't a year-round community there.
Well, I think it's great. I mean, I think that's really cool. You get to go to school and on an island. How fun is that?
And it's a beautiful ferry ride over.
Yeah, and then having your own island most of the time, until spring anyway, you've got a real kind of a beautiful, surrounded by nature community of people dedicated to marine science all around you. And talk about immersion education, it's fantastic. You mentioned the Billion Oyster Project. Can you just say a brief word about what that project is?
Sure. Once we got out to Governor's Island, we were a little bit, we realized that a couple things. First of all, we didn't have anything that all of our students could work on together in the harbor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a trash cleanup or go do some water quality monitoring or go drive a boat. But what are we all doing together? We didn't have that. The other thing is we didn't really have something that we could spread the programs that we created around the city very much. It was just all within Harbor School. The third thing we realized was that we'd created this entire school curriculum based on New York Harbor, and yet the harbor was still really inaccessible and dirty and not really as abundant a place as it used to be historically.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started doing research about what can we do together as a school community to restore New York Harbor. And Mark Kolanski had written a book called The Big Oyster, where he painted just the most vivid and beautiful picture about the huge relevance that oysters had in New York City, and that New York City was built on its relationship with oysters, and New York City was oyster capital of the world. There were 220,000 acres of oyster reefs in New York Harbor, but we ate them all, and they're all gone, and they've been functionally extinct in New York Harbor for 100 years.
Mm.
And as a keystone species, if you restore oysters, that each one has a disproportionately positive impact on the ecosystem. And so over the course of about 3 years, the aquaculture teacher at Harbor School, Pete Malinowski, and I worked on creating this thing that we ended up calling the Billion Oyster Project. And our goal is to plant 1 billion live oysters in New York Harbor by 2035 so they can perform ecosystem services like cleaning the water and creating habitat and helping slow down and stop storms that the oyster reefs once protected New York City from storms, and we removed them, we removed those barriers. And so they had a really important role that we think they still can play. So that's the, now we're doing that with schools all over the city. We have 70 other partner schools, and we're collecting oyster shells for the project from 70 partner restaurants. It's been a way that we can spread the work at Harbor School throughout the whole city.
That's fantastic. And who knew that oysters clean the water? I think that's a great project there. And we're just about to wrap up here, but how can our listeners learn more about the New York Harbor School?
Well, we have the two easiest ways would be we have two websites. One is the NewYorkHarborSchool.org, and the other one is BillionOysterProject.org. Please check that out. We're actually going to be out at the World Ocean Festival this Sunday on Governor's Island. We'd love anybody in the New York region to come out to Governor's Island. The first time the United Nations has hosted a World Ocean Festival, and we're so excited that it's going to be on our home turf on Governor's Island. And also, you know, we get a lot of exposure from groups like who you're about to interview, RARE, because we are a one little group in New York City. It's doing something really great right in our region, but we have no ability to scale that up throughout the world. But what RARE has helped us do is, show that the work that we do can be a great model for other places around the world. And so I was excited to hear just now that y'all are going to be interviewing Brett. And please say hello to him for me.
Will do, and that's all the time we have. Murray Fisher of the New York Harbor School, thank you so very much for being with us today and for creating a great model of education.
Thank you so much, Eleanor. Have a good day.
Our next guests are Brett Jenks, President and CEO of the organization RARE, which Murray just mentioned, and also Melissa Wright of Bloomberg Philanthropy's Environment Program focused on the oceans. They're here to talk with us about the depletion of fisheries and what's working in fisheries conservation. Brett Jenks and Melissa Wright, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you for having us, Eleanor.
It's a great
pleasure.
Thank you.
I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah, this is exciting. Well, I saw Brett speak also at that Earth Optimism Summit. Was so excited to find a group called RARE, which is looking for what works and trying to bring it to scale all over the world. So that's great. And I know, Melissa, you at Bloomberg Philanthropies have partnered with Brett's group RARE and are doing some fantastic work together. So, Brett, let's start with you. What is the mission of your group known as RARE?
Well, RARE's mission is to inspire change so people and nature thrive. So we've been at this for several decades now. The focus has always been on inspiring local leaders to adopt practices that motivate people, that enable sustainable behaviors to be adopted. So we work with fishers, we work with farmers, we work in throughout the developing world, helping ensure that the natural resources on which people depend are there in perpetuity.
Fantastic. And we know that one of the biggest environmental problems facing humanity right now is the depletion of fisheries. I was shocked to see that estimate that like 90% of the fisheries have been depleted or overfished. Is that true? How badly are fisheries depleted, and what are you finding that works to protect and even restore the fisheries?
Well, yeah, it is true, unfortunately, that your fact's correct. About 90% of the world's fisheries are either fully or overexploited. I mean, in simple terms, if we measured fish populations around the world like a tank of gas, it'd be fair to say we're at a quarter tank. We have severely depleted our natural fish populations. And I think, you know, the stats are one thing. It's important to understand the real nature of this problem and its significance, because not a lot of people know that this is a problem. We don't think much about fish day to day. But if you imagine there's 3 billion people who depend on fish for about 20% of their animal protein. There's a billion people, literally, United States of America, a billion people who depend on fish for their number one supply of animal protein, meaning that's the protein they get. And these are often the world's poorest people living along very climate-vulnerable coastlines. And so from a food security standpoint or an economic development standpoint, because there's also about 100 million people, maybe as many as 200 million people whose jobs depend on these fisheries, It's a really big deal. And so losing these fisheries is important from is something we desperately want to avoid from a food security standpoint. It's also important just if you think about it from an environmental standpoint. Overfishing is one of the greatest threats to nature under the sea, to coral reefs, to seagrass beds, to mangroves. And so if we continue on this path of overfishing globally, we run the risk of running out of food for a lot of people and severely deteriorating the natural resources on which tourism and natural ocean infrastructure depends. So it's a really big deal. There are some bright spots. About 5 years ago, we decided we wanted to learn, you know, rather than focus on the plight of the ocean, we wanted to figure out what was actually working out there. So we created an online prize competition called Solution Search, and we put up some prize money with a partner, National Geographic, and we said we will award a $20,000 prize and a lot of propaganda and marketing to the best community project that has addressed overfishing. And what was fascinating about that is in just about 6 weeks, we heard from more than 100 local projects in more than 40 countries all over the planet who said that they had found some way of beginning to address their own overfishing challenges. And so those bright spots, as we like to call them, have really informed RARE's approach moving forward. And so just to highlight a couple of those, one of the bright spots we saw was in Chile, where local communities were given exclusive rights to manage their coastal fisheries, usually benthic species like oysters or mussels. And some of them were doing quite well managing their own plots on the sea. We also saw in the Philippines groups that had figured out how to enforce their local waters, you know, to keep out industrial fishers or to keep out rogue fishers from other communities. And they were seeing their fish stocks increase. In Zanzibar, we saw an example of a Muslim cleric who had convinced communities that they needed to take greater care of their marine protected areas. And they were measuring growing fish stocks. So whether they're cultural approaches like religious edicts and marketing, or local enforcement, or rights, exclusive access rights for local fishers, we found enough hope that we said, well, let's take what we're already good at, motivating communities to adopt new sustainable practices, and let's create a bundle of these bright spots. And that led to a program that we called Fish Forever, because the idea was that we wanted to enable communities to do just that, to fish sustainably forever. And then eventually we were discovered by Bloomberg Philanthropies, who teamed us up with Oceana, an ocean advocacy group, and that led to this really promising program that we have been developing together in the Philippines and Brazil and Chile.
Fantastic. Well, that's an incredible story. And Melissa, you're part of Bloomberg Philanthropies, and you're working in partnership with Brett. Talk a little bit about the program that you're working on together with Brett.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again for having me on the show. We're so proud to be working with RARE and Oceana on what we call the Vibrant Oceans Initiative. It's a five-year effort. We've put in about $53 million to boost fish populations and ensure a reliable food supply for the livelihoods of people in the Philippines and Brazil. And we're also working in Chile with Oceana. And with RARE as a partner really leading this implementation for these management strategies for small-scale fishers, and Oceana focusing at the national level, leading advocacy and enforcement elements of the program. We really see that this combined effort, it's the first one of its kind to reform both industrial and local fishing simultaneously. So instead of just focusing on one or the other, but the comprehensive picture of what fisheries are facing in these places, it's also the first time that a private capital strategy has been integrated into the fisheries reform effort. We brought on Encourage Capital, who put together investment blueprints on sustainable fisheries. And so we're really excited to see some of those rolling out in places like the Philippines. And I'm sure Brett could probably speak to that a bit more. But we're really committed to this effort, in part because it's so in line with the way that Michael Bloomberg views his philanthropic strategy and how he really sees that we can address some of the most critical problems facing the world today, like fisheries, like climate change. So we're, you know, we're thrilled to be given the chance to work with these groups in these places and beginning to see transformation actually in the water and in the lives of these people.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, this whole idea of focusing on what works is near and dear to my heart, and I actually spent 20 years going around the United States looking for the best of what's working in America and put it together in a book with an introduction by the Dalai Lama called Breakthrough Solutions. And I'm convinced if we would focus more on what works, we could adapt and adopt those programs more widely. It's the fastest way to help the most people for the least amount of money that's out there. So I love that both of you are doing that, and it's a powerful, powerful strategy. I love that Michael Bloomberg has that as, you know, a big part of his philanthropic strategy, identify what works and bring it to scale. So you touched on the fact you're doing some of this work in the Philippines and Brazil and that you're seeing some results. I know it's a little bit early on, but what kinds of positive changes are you seeing?
Melissa, you want to take that one?
Sorry, yeah. So we're really seeing some positive changes in Brazil, just the level of engagement by local communities and the empowerment that they now have to participate in conversations with their provincial governments, with the national government about setting appropriate science-based targets and actually collecting data on their fisheries. All of this is so important because, you know, as you know, you can't manage what you never measure. And so these types of efforts are just so important for the national level scale, the commercial fisheries, but all the way down to the community level, like in the communities that RARE is working in.
Fantastic. And Brett, we know it's wonderful to have these bright spots, as you're talking about, successful approaches for the oceans and for the fisheries. And we know that to really make a difference, we have to bring these successful approaches, as they say, to scale, to have those approaches used more widely. Do we have any success stories yet, any so-called bright spots in bringing fishery restoration to scale?
Yeah, no doubt. There are a number of really promising and exciting examples within our work and around the world. Just here in the United States, seeing what, for example, a closing off a fishery, creating a big marine protected area has done. If you take George's Bank off the coast of New England, which was closed a number of years ago, the design was to help bring back the cod. And what's been really surprising is a huge increase in the haddock population. And the lesson there is pretty obvious. If you leave the ocean alone, it has a great propensity to recover. And so whether it's an example like that close to home, simply setting up a no fishing area and watching the haddock rebound, or what may even be more important long term is having whole networks and whole systems that combine better fishing with closures in order to recover these fish stocks are really what we believe is going to happen in the future. That's what's needed. So when we look specifically at our work in let's take the Philippines, we've been tracking the ecological recovery, biological recovery of the waters off of 8 different municipalities over the last 5 years. And just in really about 4 years of having local management in place with some fish sanctuaries established, we've seen a 212% average increase in local fish populations. That's an enormous turnaround and a bright spot of bright spots, if you will. What that's enabled us to do is take the data, take the stories, take the 8 municipal presidents, as well as increasingly many others, and begin to turn a grassroots self-actuated movement into a national policy reform strategy. And so from the grassroots, by working community by community over several years, we now have a groundswell of local support for improving small-scale fisheries on which the Philippines depends that is now enabling us to meaningfully engage with, for example, the National Economic Development Agency and the Ministries of Agriculture and Bureau of Fisheries, organizations that now see for really the first time in several generations an opportunity to systematically improve the livelihoods of local fishers and restore or protect the habitats that are not only important for fisheries, but are critically important for ecotourism, dive tourism, as well as I'm sure our friend Murray Fisher from the Billion Oyster Project described, creating the natural infrastructure that protects the Philippines from climate events, from storm surges and the like. The only thing I would add to that is, you know, this is so important to be building bright spots, in particular for small-scale fisheries, because for years, organizations, friends of ours, our peers in this space, have been focusing on large marine protected areas or industrial fishery reform. And the good news is we've started to make a lot of progress. You know, more than 2% of the ocean is now protected, and increasingly industrial fisheries are being reformed and technology is being brought to bear. But what's been left behind, what we call the forgotten fisheries increasingly, are the small-scale fishers. And what's so ironic is that small-scale fisheries are actually a really big deal. Small-scale fisheries employ 95% of the world's fishers. They provide more than half of the seafood that people actually eat. And so these are critically important forgotten fisheries, and these emerging bright spots, you know, in the coastal communities of Brazil and the Philippines, really give hope to national leaders from developing nations all over the world that they can also restore their fisheries. And so we see these five, eight mayors leading to 5 to 8 ministers, leading to 5 to 8 countries, eventually leading to a global movement for a vibrant ocean.
Right. Well, it may happen that way, kind of going up from the grassroots up to the national, and it can also happen, you know, from small town to small town with that kind of sharing of information and support. And I commend you for working, you know, working both sides of it. You know, there is a concern sometimes when you hit the national level that you have national government dysfunction or corruption that makes it really hard to make anything move at a national level. But what I love about what you both are working on is that you're working at the local level in a place where you can really get traction and really get results. So that's good. And I know, Melissa, I know that's one of the big strategies for Michael Bloomberg and his philanthropy is working through municipalities, him having been the mayor of New York City, talking to other mayors around the world. So are you going to, are you working through those connections with mayors and other municipalities to work on the fishery solutions?
Absolutely. So as you say, Michael Bloomberg has been a major proponent of empowerment of local leaders through his role as the UN Special Envoy for Cities and Climate Change. He just released a fantastic new book called Climate of Hope that talks about how cities, citizens, and businesses can really drive climate action. And, you know, I think at this very moment we're hearing the news from our current U.S. administration about the climate deal, so this is especially relevant. That the role of local leaders is huge in making sure that these local solutions add up to something even larger. So you know, I in working with RARE in the Philippines and in Brazil, it's you know, just demonstrating how much we believe in scaling these solutions, but engaging strong partners. And some of the strongest partners are people who know the local issues, who know their, you know, how to get things done. They are the ones who have the incentive and the direct benefit to working on some of these issues and, you know, protecting their local waters.
Fantastic. And Brett, did you want to comment on kind of the local action versus national action for fishery solutions getting enacted more widely?
Yeah, I'd love to. Well, first, I'd give a big shout out, especially given what the U.S. administration just announced a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. I'd give a big shout out to Michael Bloomberg as well, because I was in Paris during the COP in December of 2015, when we basically were able to, you know, I witnessed the power of bringing hundreds of mayors from all over the world and bringing them together with the mayor of Paris in advance of the climate negotiations to create this specter of inevitability of a global climate commitment. I think what we lose sight of is just how important that network of committed local leaders offers when we need resilience. And so I think it is equally inevitable that the march to sustainability will continue regardless of Donald Trump's decision to pull out of the Paris Accord today. And I think the same can be said of our work with small-scale fisheries. This is why RARE has spent decades figuring out how to change behavior in rural communities, how to instill a sense of civic pride and an interest in sustainability and self-interest among the fishers and farmers of the world's most high biodiversity nations, because it not only, it works both ways. We start from the ground up and build capacity, build interest, build momentum, so that it makes the case irrefutable to national leaders that there is a sustainable future. When administrations change, though, that groundswell of local support, the entrenched sustainable movement, whether it's for fisheries or sustainable ag or green energy, it makes those changes far more likely to stick. So regardless of an administrative change, there is still a local lasting commitment to protecting nature while protecting livelihoods. And I think we are witnessing that power right now in our communities and around the world, both on fisheries and climate change.
I think you're so right, and it is very distressing that Trump wants to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement, but at the same time, I think you're right. There's a march to sustainability that's going to continue irrespective of that or related action. There's another piece of news today is about how an ExxonMobil shareholders are demanding that they kind of address the issues of you know, the future of the fossil fuel industry and the march mm-hmm. towards sustainable energy. And you're not talking about kind of just Greenpeace there. You're talking about major financial organizations are saying to ExxonMobil, you as a company have to address and show how you're addressing the move away from fossil fuels and the move towards sustainability. And it was organizations like Vanguard was really one of the financial institutions pushing ExxonMobil just as a matter of basic business practice mm-hmm. to really seriously address the climate change challenges to that company. So I think we're going to see, and we are seeing more and more of that happening. So what about for our listeners here? You two know so much about the fisheries and some of these bright spots and success stories. Is there anything our listeners can do to save our fisheries, and how can they learn more about your work?
Melissa, you want to take that, or you want me to take that?
You can go ahead.
Okay, well, I'll just say a couple things briefly, and then you can add on. First, any consumer, any day of the week, can make a better decision, and those decisions add up. You think about the number of people going into local markets, whether it's New York City or Idaho Falls, there is an opportunity to make a good decision about what you're purchasing. And so just buying certified, sustainable seafood is a really important gesture. And when hundreds of millions of people start buying sustainable seafood, you have a market movement, the likes of which you just described with ExxonMobil and climate change. So one thing is just buy better fish, buy high quality fish, buy certified sustainable fish. I would probably not be the guy running a nonprofit conservation organization, if I didn't say they could also, your listeners could also help save fish by going on rare.org, going onto our website, learning more about what they can do, and making a contribution to support the civil society that's out there providing the capacity and the motivation to save fisheries on which, you know, more than a billion people depend. I think they could also pick up Mike Bloomberg's book, because there's a specific link between his Climate of Hope, really terrific book. There's a specific link between what we do as citizens day to day and climate change and the plight of our oceans. And they're all connected. And I think increasingly people understand that, whether you're paying your electricity bill or you're buying a product at a supermarket, all of those behaviors are actually driving either the depletion or the recovery of natural resources around the world. So there's actually a lot more that they can do than they think.
Fantastic. That's a great summary. And Melissa, did you have anything to add briefly?
Just, I wanted to end on a note of optimism. I think that people around the world have really rallied over the last several years around climate change, around some of the major environmental problems. And regardless of the political climate, regardless of who's in power, we all retain our ability to act in our communities and educate people around us and to really drive for change. So, you know, I feel confident that together we're going to make a difference on climate and in our ocean.
Fantastic. And both of you are contributing mightily to that, and I thank you for that. And that's all the time we have. Brett Jenks, President and CEO of RARE, and Melissa Wright of Bloomberg Philanthropies, thank you very much for being with us and for your important work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Eleanor.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.